good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 569 of Unwelcome Guests, The Light Within and the Lost Art of Seeing. I'm Robin Upton. And that rather cryptic title hints at a rather cryptic show, perhaps even a rather Gnostic show, this week. The subtitle, Can Technology Make the Handicapped Whole?, is the title of our first piece, a reading of an essay published on the web by Steve Talbot, whom we've heard before on the show. And that is looking at the prospect of the techno fix applied to human beings. And the main subject of that, Jacques Lusseron, is the author of our second piece, The Blind in Society. Lusseron, as a teenager, started one of the largest French resistance movements against Nazi wartime occupation. Now, he was completely blind, which challenges commonly held ideas about disability, but, as we shall hear, made him uniquely suited for the role in a number of ways. Now, that reading continues into our second hour, and we conclude the show with an interview by Barry Vogel of Radio Curious. He's interviewing Laura Fogg, a blind guide, author of Traveling Blind, Life Lessons from Unlikely Places. Now, as an introduction to the ethical and medical problems of assistive technology, I thought I'd summarize an article from April last year. The full story is linked in from this show's webpage. The headline, Spokane Father Won't Force Deaf Daughter to wear required cochlear implants. And a cochlear implant, in case you don't know, is a mechanical hearing device which is implanted into the ear to provide some level of hearing. And the earlier you get used to using it, the more normal your hearing is. And it centers on an 8-year-old girl born to a hearing mother and a deaf father. And they are separated, and when she is with her mum, she turns it on, and when she's with her dad, she wants to be, quote, deaf like daddy, so she turns it off and communicates in American Sign Language. Her mother's not happy with this and has brought a lawsuit with supporting evidence from the local ear, nose and throat clinic that stressed the importance of wearing the devices at all times for continued progress with her hearing and speech. And her father, by allowing her not to turn it on, may be running the risk of a contempt charge. Now, I don't know the outcome of this case, but I did recall some thoughts about, is it tantamount to child abuse if you don't give a cochlear implant to your children from a very early age, because you're retarding their later ability to hear. Now, I'm quite familiar with the deaf community, and it's a matter of continual regret from adults what they see as an ongoing cultural genocide, because the idea is energetically being pushed that parents should try to unhandicap their children by allowing them to hear. Now, if that seems a completely uncontroversial idea, then I hope by the end of the show you will at least appreciate that there's two sides to this debate. Now let's get started with Can Technology Make the Disabled Whole?, an essay published on the internet by Steve Talbot in 1999. Can technology make the handicapped whole? If, along our passage to a tolerable, technology-permeated future, there lies a single stretch where we will have to sweat drops of blood in order to stay the course, surely it will be that stretch peopled by the handicapped. Here is where, no matter how radical or uncertain or dangerous a technology promises to be for society at large, we will be overwhelmingly tempted by our own generous impulses to grant exceptions for the disabled. And from retinal or cochlear implants to machine-harnessed brainwaves to wholesale fiddling with the nervous system, this is probably enough of a beachhead to bring the technology into general use. Who could deny any possible technical assist to the tragic victims of a major functional deficit? In The Age of Spiritual Machines, Ray Kurzweil makes the argument as explicit as possible, repeatedly reminding his readers that we're on a slippery slope. He plunges into the downhill slide with resigned abandon. Eventually, he assures us, we will replace the entire human body and its intelligence with vastly more capable digital technologies. To combine these metaphors a bit awkwardly, the narrow passage is our only alternative to the slippery slope. This article is my attempt not to traverse the passage, but at least to point it out. I may not have sweated drops of blood while writing these words, but I don't think I've ever written a piece under a more compelling sense of urgency or with a greater awareness of my own inadequacy. The article takes the form of a commentary on a book, the book having been written in 1953 without any mention of computers. Nevertheless, I do not know any work more germane to this matter at hand, and I count the book among the handful of the most significant productions of this century. You may find the initial unfolding of the story strange, and wonder about its relevance to the theme of technology and the disabled. Please stick with it and read on. And the book that he's talking about is the autobiography of Jacques Lucero, And There Was Light. In Paris, in the spring of 1941, the 16-year-old Jacques Lucero stood in front of the 52 carefully chosen boys and young men. His panic of a few days previous, panic at the thought of carrying this responsibility, was now behind him. In assured tones, he explained to the 52 that they would not be able to close the door that they opened that night. What we were making, they and I together, was called a resistance movement. The fact that the oldest of us was not yet 21, and that I was not quite 17, though it did not make all our operations simple, made some of them possible. So long as people thought of us as kids, they would not suspect us, at least not right away. And so it was that Lucéran created the Volunteers of Liberty in Nazi-occupied France. Growing to 600 members over the next year or two, it published and distributed an underground newspaper, created a network for the protection and repatriation of downed English airmen, and later joined forces with the Defence of France to publish what would eventually become France Soir, the most important daily newspaper in Paris. Hearing with more than ears. The young Jacques was entrusted by his co-conspirators with sole responsibility for recruiting new members for the Volunteers of Liberty. For one thing, his extraordinary memory allowed him to report on his contacts and to summarize the week's intelligence without writing notes on scraps of paper, scraps that might be found by the wrong people. More importantly, those who knew him believed he had a special sense for the human being, a sense that was infallible, or nearly so. This special inner sense, feeding upon images, colours, textures, sounds, was a gift Lucéran already possessed as a young boy. He tells, for example, of the time his math teacher, came into the classroom, clapped his hands, and boldly began his lecture. He was lucid that day, as he usually was, perhaps more interesting than ever, a little too interesting. His voice, instead of falling into place at the end of a sentence, as it should have, going a tone or two down the scale, hung in the air, a bit sharp. It was as though the teacher wanted to hide something that day, put a good face on it before an unknown audience, prove that he was not giving in, that he would carry on to the end because he had to. Meanwhile, accustomed to the cadence of his sentences falling as regularly as the beat of a metronome, I listened attentively, and I was distressed on his account. I wanted to help, but that seemed foolish, for I had no reason for thinking him unhappy. All the same, he was unhappy, bitterly unhappy. The terrible intelligence of gossip told us a week later that his wife had just left him. Lucerant then goes on, I ended by reading so many things into voices without wanting to, without even thinking about it, that voices concern me more than the words they spoke. Sometimes, for minutes at a time in class, I heard nothing, neither the teacher's questions nor the answers of my comrades. I was too much absorbed by the images that their voices were parading through my head, all the more since these images half the time contradicted, and flagrantly, the appearance of things. For instance, a student named Paco had just been given 100 by the teacher of history. I was astonished, because Paco's voice had informed me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he understood nothing. He had recited the lesson, but only with his lips. His voice sounded like an empty rattle, with no substance in the sound. The beautiful voice, and beautiful, means a great deal in this context, for it means that the man who has such a voice is beautiful himself, remains so through coughing and stammering. An ugly voice, on the contrary, can become soft, scented, humming, singing like the flute, but to no purpose. It stays ugly just the same. As recruiter and co-leader of one of the 5 largest resistance organizations in France, Lucerant enjoyed many striking successes. But in 1943, he and many of his comrades were betrayed to the Germans, imprisoned for 6 months and interrogated by the Gestapo. Then they were shipped off to Buchenwald. Of the 2,000 persons in this shipment, Lucerant was one of about 30 who remained alive when General Patton's troops liberated Buchenwald 15 months later. The remarkable thing is that Lucerant could not see. He had totally lost his sight in an accident when he was between 7 and 8 years old. It was to a blind youth that his comrades in the resistance entrusted their fate, and it was the same blind youth who found the hidden resources to survive the horrors of Buchenwald. Lost sight, second sight. Growing up, the young Jacques seemed almost intoxicated with life. He was forever running. The whole of my childhood was spent running. Only I was not running to catch hold of something. That is a notion for grown-ups and not the notion of a child. I was running to meet everything that was visible and everything that I could not yet see. I travelled from assurance to assurance as though I were running a race in relays. He recalls a vivid moment of self-realization on his 4th birthday when he was running along the pavement toward a triangle of light. I was being projected toward this pool of light, drawn up by it, and waving my arms and legs, cried out to myself, I am 4 years old and I'm Jacques! Before his accident, he was fascinated, above all, by light. He spent hours watching it flow over the buildings and streets of his neighborhood. Even darkness held light for him. But, in a new form and a new rhythm, nothing in the world, not even what I saw inside myself with closed eyelids, was outside this great miracle of light. Then, one Easter holiday, as his family was preparing to return to Paris from a country vacation, the young boy was overtaken by the sadness of a strange presentiment. Surveying the sunlit garden of his country home, he began to cry. When his mother asked what the trouble was, he answered, "I'm never going to see the garden again." 3 weeks later, the accident occurred. Bumped by a fellow student in a classroom, his head fell against the corner of a desk, and the rigid frame of his glasses gouged deeply into him. One eye had to be removed, and the other, with a badly torn retina, was completely blind. Here, it must be said, that one of the miracles of Luceron's book, although it emerges mostly as unspoken background, is the miracle of his parents. Beyond the first few pages, his parents are scarcely mentioned, but what he does say in those first pages bears just about the highest praise any parent could hope for. "My parents were protection, confidence, warmth. When I think of my childhood, I still feel the sense of warmth above me, behind and around me, that marvelous sense of living not yet on one's own, but leaning body and soul on others who accept the charge. My parents carried me along, and that, I am sure, is the reason why through all my childhood I never touched ground. I could go away and come back. Objects had no weight, and I never became entangled in the web of things. I passed between dangers and fears as light passes through a mirror. That was the joy of my childhood, the magic armor which, once put on, protects for a lifetime." This coming and going, this weightlessness or lightness of being, incidentally, is a far different matter from the too shrilly celebrated freedom and weightlessness of cyberspace. The latter sort of weightlessness is often spoken of today as a feature of the world of bits rather than the world of atoms. But the lightness of the young Jacques was a consequence of his incessant running to meet things of the atom world, and his discovering that all these things, when truly engaged, speak the weightless language of light. Amazingly, even after Jacques' accident, his parents never suggested in any way that he was deprived of the light, or that he suffered a deficit or handicap. The accident was treated matter-of-factly, like all other events of childhood, and the assumption was that, just as before, Jacques would continue doing all the things his circumstances allowed, without special fuss. And why should he have been treated as a special case? As Luceron himself says, "Children never complain against circumstances, unless, of course, grown-ups are so foolish as to suggest it to them. For an eight-year-old, what is always best. He knows nothing of bitterness or anger. He may have a sense of injustice, but only if injustice comes from people. For him, events are always signs from God." The stance of Luceron's parents meant that, in an era when this was almost unheard of, he continued going to the same school he attended before, where he received first prize in his class at the end of the next year. Eventually, he would enter an elite upper first class in the university. Later, after passing tests for the highest educational institution in France, the École Normale Supérieure, he would be denied entry by the collaborationist government at Vichy. Why? Because of his physical defect. Dangers. But the most remarkable of all was Luceron's claim that despite his total blindness, he learned to see. Not at once, I admit. Not in the days immediately after the operation, for at that time I still wanted to use my eyes. I followed their usual path. I looked in the direction where I was in the habit of seeing before the accident, and there was anguish, a lack, something like a void, which filled me with what grown-ups call despair. Finally, one day, and it was not long in coming, I realized that I was looking in the wrong way. It was as simple as that. I was making something very like the mistake people make who change their glasses without adjusting themselves. I was looking too far off, too much on the surface of things. And so he changed course, looking not at things, but at a world closer to myself, looking from an inner place to one further within, instead of clinging to the movement of sight towards the world outside. Immediately, the substance of the universe drew together, redefined and peopled itself anew. I was aware of a radiance emanating from a place I knew nothing about, a place which might as well have been outside me as within. But radiance was there, or, to put it more precisely, light. It was a fact, for light was there. Not only light, but also colour. My father and mother, the people I met or ran into in the street, all had their characteristic colour, which I had never seen before I went blind. Yet now this special attribute impressed itself on me as part of them, as definitely as any impression created by a face. Still, the colours were only a game. White light was my whole reason for being. I let it rise in me like water in a well, and I rejoiced. But this inner light sometimes departed. Fear, anger, and impatience were enough to make Jacques blind again. When he lost his confidence and began to fear the obstacles in his way, he could no longer move easily among them. Everything hurt him. What the loss of my eyes had not accomplished, he wrote, was brought about by fear. Perhaps an even greater danger than his own fear lay in the reactions of others. In the book, Lucerne gives great credit to his parents for not imagining that their own way of knowing the world was the only one. He advises parents of a blind child never to say, "Oh, you can't do that because you can't see," and to say as little as possible, "Don't do that, it's dangerous." The adult's pity, fear, and embarrassment are the worst disaster for someone who has been blinded, as one of Lucerne's encounters makes clear. When I was 15, I spent long afternoons with a blind boy my own age, one who went blind, I should add, in circumstances very like my own. Today, I have few memories as painful. This boy terrified me. He was the living image of everything that might have happened to me if I had not been fortunate, more fortunate than he, for he was really blind. He had seen nothing since his accident. His faculties were normal. He could have seen as well as I, but they had kept him from doing so. To protect him, as they put it, they had cut him off from everything and made fun of all his attempts to explain what he felt. In grief and revenge he had thrown himself into a brutal solitude. Even his body lay prostrate in the depths of an armchair. To my horror, I saw that he didn't like me. When we devise technical aids for the disabled, we need to ask ourselves to what degree our thinking aligns itself with Lucerne's upbringing or with that of his unhappy acquaintance. Our attitude in this respect, after all, is probably much more significant for the person we would help than is all the technical wizardry we put at his disposal. Attending to the world with new eyes. Lucerne's story presents a mystery for us sighted people, who speak so naturally of the night of blindness. It's not easy to understand what he means by seeing. Throughout his book, he tells how his freedom of movement was restricted by his blindness, and how he spent much of his time guided by friends as he walked, or ran, through city and countryside. But, at the same time, these friends quickly learned to take it for granted that, in some ways, he saw more of this passage than they did, so that he was often at least as quick as they to warn of danger or to announce what lay over the next rise. He tells how objects in his environment would come to life on his inner canvas, how his senses of hearing, smell, and touch gained revelatory qualities that departed in wildly unexpected ways from the normal performances of these senses, and how all objects exert a kind of pressure, even from a distance, a pressure one can respond to in an intimate sensory dance that blurs the visually enforced boundaries commonly felt between object and perceiver. As to his seeing in particular, here is one of his attempts to describe it. As I walked along a country road bordered by trees, I could point to each one of the trees by the road, even if they were not spaced at regular intervals. I knew whether the trees were straight and tall, carrying their branches as a body carries its head, or gathered into thickets and partly covering the ground around them. This kind of exercise soon tired me out, I must admit, but it succeeded, and the fatigue did not come from the trees, from their number or shape, but from myself. To see them like this, I had to hold myself in a state so far removed from old habits that I could not keep it up for very long. I had to let the trees come towards me, and not allow the slightest inclination to move towards them, the smallest wish to know them, to come between them and me. I could not afford to be curious or impatient or proud of my accomplishment. After all, such a state is only what one commonly calls attention. But I can testify that, when carried to this point, it is not easy. All this may remind some readers of the ancient doctrine that we actually see by virtue of two lights, one of which, more subtle, streams out from us, and the other of which streams from without into our eyes. It may remind others of the findings of 20th century studies in perception. In his book, The Organism, neurologist Kurt Goldstein demonstrated that the senses, like all other parts of the organism, never deliver isolated and local performances. For example, every visual sense impression corresponds to a different muscle tension. If one asks a patient, preferably a cerebellar patient, who exhibits these phenomena often exceptionally clearly, to raise his arms forward so that they are in a somewhat unstable position, and if one exposes him to various colors, e.g. large sheets of colored paper, we notice that green and blue stimulation lead to a change of the position of the arms in the opposite direction as that induced by yellow or red stimulation. More generally, color influences our volitional movements, so that, depending on whether a light is red or green, movements are carried out with a different speed, even though the difference is not subjectively experienced. Likewise, the estimates of traversed distances vary as to length. Seen and felt distances, time intervals, and weights are judged differently under the influence of different colors. Goldstein notes that stimulation of the skin by different colors can also lead to different effects. In sum, it is probably not a false statement to say that a specific color stimulation is accompanied by a specific response pattern of the entire organism. And this is true even when the stimulation does not involve sense objects in the usual sense of the term, as when infrared or ultraviolet light is experienced. All this stands to reason. If the organism is a unity, a whole in the deepest sense, then every effort precisely to define a deficit, a missing piece, or a missing function is problematic. Given a true organism, you can, to one degree or another, without predefined limit, arrive at the whole through any of its parts, because the whole is immanent in each of the parts. In all our senses, form a unity that can be gotten at, with more or less success, depending on our inner resources, through any combination of them. The human being as a developing potential. Today we are strongly inclined to technologize every disability, conceiving it as wholly defined by a specific malfunction of a piece of machinery, and immediately setting about the task of fixing the malfunction, as if that were the whole story. What Lucien's experience suggests is that this is only a tiny part of the story, and perhaps the least important part. By restricting our notion of seeing to the narrowest of mechanisms, the eyeball understood as a camera, we close ourselves off to many of life's richest possibilities. Lucien himself had little patience for such attitudes, noting that the blind suffer greatly from the inexperience of those who still have their eyes. He goes on to laud his parents, whose hearts and intelligence were open to spiritual things, for whom the world was not composed exclusively of objects that were useful, and useful always in the same fashion, for whom, above all, it was not necessarily a curse to be different from other people. Finally, mine were parents willing to admit that their way of looking at things, the usual way, was perhaps not the only possible one, and to like my way, and to encourage it. Indeed, as Lucien remarks elsewhere, after his accident, his father said to him, "Always tell us when you discover something." What extraordinary and liberating advice! One of my own sons had experience of synesthesia, perception of sound as colour, when he was young, and I have often regretted not having found a way to make a natural place for such experiences in the home. In general, I suspect that if the imaginations and perceptions of childhood, above all, the perceptions of ensouled nature that come so naturally to children, were not systematically suppressed by adult obtuseness, we would live in a radically different world today. A new collection of Lucien's essays is just coming out, and it is available. In its introduction, Christopher Bamford mentions a Dutch girl born deaf. Remarkably, her parents decided to treat her as if she could hear. So they spoke to her constantly, read stories, and sang songs. The girl grew up to be exceptionally intelligent and happy, and she speaks clearly, without the slurring common among the deaf. Today she counsels the parents of deaf children. She also enjoys music and goes to concerts. As Bamford observes, evidently we hear with more than our ears. In fact, the story of the Dutch girl puts in question whether we hear sound in the usual sense at all. His point, if I take him correctly, is that understanding comes to us along innumerable dimensions, the sum of which is that one person participates with another in a world of love and meaning. To reduce the possibilities of that shared world to the bare potentials of an imagined set of one-dimensional mechanisms is to lose sight of nearly everything that counts. saving illnesses. It is one of the characteristic pathologies of our day that we would like to deny the connection between limitation and suffering on the one hand and profound accomplishment on the other. But the link remains, and one particular episode in Lucerne's autobiography offers a beautiful illustration of it. After the Germans invaded France, the young Jacques was struck by what became of Paris. It was a puzzle he couldn't solve. Yes, the Germans were largely invisible, and life went on much as before. Everything seemed roughly the same. Yet, he sensed in everyone's attitude that the world had somehow shifted catastrophically. He couldn't help noticing the tenseness, withdrawal of his neighbours into their private shells, the studied silence as one person after another, especially Jews, were summoned by the authorities, never to return. All this ate away at the teenage boy terribly. Like a great societal illness that could neither be clearly identified nor shaken off, he had never lived through an occupation and didn't know what it was supposed to be like. The official story was of the Germans as benefactors. He couldn't fit the pieces together. Then, after the arrest of a friend, Lucerne fell badly ill with the measles. At the height of his illness, with fever raging, the situation suddenly became crystal clear to him. He was gripped by a powerful resolve. All the while, his system was purging itself of poisons. But the poison was moral as much as it was physical, he wrote. Of that I am sure. Thus was born the iron will and the whirlpool of renewed energy that set his resistance activities in motion. What a fortunate case of measles that was! In me it had catalyzed a pack of fears and desires, intentions and irritations which had held me closed in a tight fist for weeks, and which I should never have been able to break open myself. On the first day of convalescence, I said to myself aloud in my room, "The occupation is my sickness." If only we allowed ourselves more such personal crises today, as we confront the deeply embedded systemic ills of our society. But as our readiness to submit ourselves to mass vaccination campaigns for every minor malady suggests, we can't easily accept that illness might be necessary and beneficial, that we might end up paying more in bodily and social damage for its absence than for its presence. Accepting such a link is as hard as conceiving that blindness might be a gift. But on this we should allow the victims to speak for themselves. Lucerne's own conclusion is as direct as can be. "Since I went blind, I have never been unhappy." How do you gainsay a life that could heartily serve others in the French Resistance and find peace in a concentration camp? Finding the place for technology. After reading And There Was Light, I'm compelled to ask whether Jacques Lucerne is the one with the greater deficit, or whether I am. Might the disabled offer the main hope for discovering a world much larger than the prison we have carved out for ourselves with our known senses? There will be no shortage of people eager to lay out a path for us down the slippery slope Ray Kurzweil so enthusiastically describes, as we descend toward an ever more mechanistic view of our own capabilities. Living images of what the human being can become in the other direction will gain all the more importance, and what we can become, as Lucerne's life demonstrates so well, is inseparable from that narrow passage I mentioned at the beginning. It requires us to recognize the positive potentials in every limitation, every unwelcome blow of destiny, perhaps even every willing sacrifice of technical possibility. If it is less important for each of us, as I believe it is, that we retain our most direct instruments of sight, than that we profoundly deepen from within the perceptual capacities of our entire organism, and if it is also true, as Lucenon's story suggests, that a physical defect can lead to achievements that are in many respects beyond most normal people, then we should not assault the dignity of the blind by assuming too quickly that we know what they need in order to be whole. We should leave at least as much room for Lucifer's achievement as we do for the idea of reproducing some sort of camera vision through technical virtuosity. In slightly different terms, the welfare of society and the happiness and fulfillment of its citizens do not depend fundamentally on the availability of whatever technical devices happen to be available in 10,000 BC or 1200 AD or 1999 or 2100. They do depend fundamentally on the light that streams out from us to meet whatever comes toward us from the world. This distinction frames that narrow passage. I'm not suggesting that we should deny prostheses or other aids to the blind, or even that I would not use them myself to one degree or another. Certainly, it would be an abomination for me to dictate to a blind person whether or not he can receive a particular assist. But we need to add, it would also have been an abomination if the prevailing social attitudes about the limitations of blindness, attitudes his parents so marvellously transcended, had prevented Lucien from entering fully into the distinctive richness of his own life. To traverse the narrow passage is to keep both these abominations in mind, an act of mental balancing that few salesmen of technology, with all their talk of solutions, will be eager to encourage. Lest there be any misunderstanding, let me repeat myself. It is not for you or I to say to anyone, use or do not use this prosthesis. Continually new devices will be, and ought to be, taken up by those who can benefit from them. But if we don't at the same time sweat those drops of blood, if we don't cultivate with all the powers at our disposal the kind of inner light that Lucerant was forever running toward, then Kurzweil and all his kin will have been right. We will become machines. In other words, the lessons in Lucerant's story run at right angles to the gifts of technology. My worry arises precisely when this incommensurability is lost sight of by the proponents of technology, replaced by the assumption that technology is the answer to blindness. Such a stance might give a future Lucerant something like normal vision, but it will also continue the ongoing reduction of normal vision to a kind of blind mechanism. Lucerant, extraordinary figure that he was, might have accepted the gift of machine-assisted vision and still gone on to discover the deeper sources of sight that evidently live within us all. But the rest of us, even without having yet wholly aligned our vision with cameras and all the other image-producing services around us, have managed precious little of Lucerant's deepened sight. What can we hope for in the way of inner development as the technological model is fastened ever more securely upon our ever more machine-entranced minds? I find it very interesting that Lucerant talks about the role of fear in making him become inwardly blind, thinking about how I grew up in the Cold War, and it was explained to me very clearly that I could be dead in 4 minutes, that we get a whistle blowing, that's a 4 minute warning of what? There's nothing you can do. Then the nuclear bombs arrive and that's it. And boy, were we pleased when the Berlin Wall fell down and a lot of people talked about a peace dividend and an end to the Cold War. Well, it didn't happen. Weapons expenditure has gone up, not down, which doesn't make sense if those weapons were for fighting nation states. If those enemies are now no longer here, why do we have the weapons? Why are people in the 21st century researching the development of more efficient ways to kill people? In any technology, never mind nuclear weapons, we're going to be killing millions and millions of people in one go by pressing a button. Is that anything to do with defense? Is that even about foreign countries? Isn't it more about projecting power of an insane elite and in so doing perpetuating that fear that Lucerne found was so toxic to his development of a higher potential? Now, I don't know how many listeners there are working in the so-called defense contractors, and I hope you'll permit me a special appeal to you if you work in the arms or anti-terrorism industry. Pretty much that's the same as the terrorism industry as far as I'm concerned. Please have a think about what Lucerne is saying about the effects of these industries. And actually, I mean, why stop there? I think almost all hierarchically dominated industries, you know, you think you're working for a software company and then the arms company uses your software. You think you're just doing logistics, and yeah, that's how they send their weapons around the place. So because of the commercial imperative which has been used to dominate all of these hierarchies, most everybody who is working inside a power hierarchy is serving the interests of psychopaths one way or the other. Now, let's get on to the words of Jacques Lucerin himself. This is a reading of the first of those essays referenced by Talbot, The Blind in Society.
The long journey that brought me from the middle of the Pacific and today gives me the pleasure of meeting you in Switzerland took place on account of a book. I first wrote that book in my mother tongue, French, and called it At La Lumière Foot. Then I published it in English in the United States and England. Finally, it was translated into German with the title Das Wiedergefundene Licht. It is the story of my life, or rather of what life taught me, between the time when I completely and irrevocably lost the light of my eyes through an accident at the age of 7.5, and the spring of 1945, when I came out alive from Buchenwald concentration camp in Nazi Germany. And There Was Light is undoubtedly the most personal of the books I have written, and the most intimate. Yet it has given me the opportunity to establish contact with the greatest number of my fellow men. This does not surprise me. Whenever we take the trouble to plumb the depths of an experience and extract from it all that it contains, the simplest as well as the most hidden, we cease to speak of ourselves and ourselves alone. Instead, we enter the realm of the most precious, the realm of universal experience, which we share with all others. I do not apologize, therefore, for telling you a little more about myself today. What a man has discovered in his life, be it ever so unique, belongs to all. If his discoveries can enhance and enrich the life of others, it is his duty to speak of them. Well, that is the case here. What 37 years of blindness have taught me, I must admit, is to make great efforts. But they are much more than efforts. They are also discoveries. I can hardly wait to tell you about some of them. Barely 10 days after the accident that blinded me, I made the basic discovery. I am still entranced by it. The only way I can describe that experience is in clear and direct words. I had completely lost the sight of my eyes. I could not see the light of the world any more. Yet the light was still there. It was there. Try to imagine what a surprise that must have been for a boy not yet 8 years old. True, I could not see the light outside myself anymore. The light that illuminates objects, is associated with them, and plays on them. All the world around me was convinced that I had lost it forever. But I found it again in another place. I found it in myself. And what a miracle! It was intact. This in myself, however, what was that? In my head? In my heart? In my imagination? Don't you feel that such questions are purely intellectual and worthy only of those adults who have already forgotten the utter simplicity and unquestionable power of true experiences? For me, I was in my 8th year and lived instead of thinking. The light was there. Its source was not obliterated. I felt it gushing forth every moment and brimming over. I felt how it wanted to spread out over the world. I had only to receive it. It was unavoidably there. It was all there, and I found again its movements and shades, that is, its colors, which I had loved so passionately a few weeks before. This was something entirely new, you understand, all the more so since it contradicted everything that those who have eyes believe. The source of light is not the outer world. We believe that it is only because of a common delusion. The light dwells where life also dwells, within ourselves. Yet I had to make the effort to find my way between doors, walls, human beings, and trees. As happens to all blind persons, I hurt myself often. But I quickly learned that I knocked against things only when I forgot the light. When I paid attention to the light, I ran a much smaller risk. The second great discovery came almost immediately afterwards. There was only one way to see the inner light, and that was to love. When I was overcome with sorrow, when I let anger take hold of me, when I envied those who saw, the light immediately decreased. Sometimes it even went out completely. Then I became blind. But this blindness was a state of not loving anymore, of sadness. It was not the loss of one's eyes. I spoke to you of discoveries. This was one of them, and it was so great that a whole lifetime full of religion and morality is often not enough to enable others to make it. In another respect, too, I wish to say this here, I was exceedingly fortunate. I had parents who understood. Neither my father nor my mother ever pitied me because of my fate. They never said the word unfortunate in my presence. My father, who deeply understood the spiritual life, immediately said to me, "Always tell us when you discover something." I was to discover more and more. And he was right. One should not try to console either those who lost their eyes or those who have suffered other losses, of money, health, or a loved one. It is necessary instead to show them what their loss brings them, to show them the gifts they receive in place of what they have lost. Because there are always gifts. God wills it so. Order is restored. Nothing ever disappears completely. I knew this when I was 8 years old, because I had found the light again. From that moment on, blindness became for me a fascinating experience and the attempt to live a new way. I could not read with my eyes anymore, but what did it matter? I drew within myself letters and words on a canvas greater and more radiant than all blackboards, and within a few weeks I could learn to write again in Braille. I saw neither sun nor plants, nor the faces of those around me with my eyes. But it was enough for the warmth of the day to touch me, for a tree to appear along the way, for a voice to call me, and immediately those beings and objects came to life on the inner canvas. All that remained was to learn a few simple techniques in order to tackle everyday problems, the only ones that could still be called difficulties. Writing Braille, reading it as fluently as possible, typing on a regular typewriter because it was necessary to be able to establish direct contact with the seeing. All this I learned, fortunately, very early in life, between the ages of 8 and 10. My parents had decided further to let me stay among my seeing comrades. This was a bold decision. A special school for the blind would have offered greater guarantees and I am still of the opinion that for most blind persons a special school is the quickest and most advantageous. Yet the necessity of living under the same conditions as everyone else has taught me a great deal. I had to forget that I was blind. I had to stop thinking about it. I could compare my experiences with those of the others, and I understood very quickly that my blindness saved me from one great misery, that of living with egotists or fools. Only those who were capable of being magnanimous and understanding sought my company. It was much easier for me to choose my comrades. I never met the boys and girls who expect only personal gain from friendship, because they never came to me. So I met the best, first in public school, then at high school in Paris, without ever having to make an effort. They were there, close to me, with me. They asked me questions, and I asked them in turn. They helped me to live as if I had eyes, to learn to climb trees, to row a boat, and sometimes to steal apples. And to their surprise, and often to my own, I taught them to see better. Because of my blindness, I had developed a new faculty. Strictly speaking, all men have it, but almost all forget to use it. That faculty is attention. In order to live without eyes, it is necessary to be very attentive, to remain hour after hour in a state of wakefulness, of receptivity and activity. Indeed, attention is not simply a virtue of intelligence or the result of education, and something one can easily do without. It is a state of being. It is a state without which we shall never be able to perfect ourselves. In its truest sense, it is the listening post of the universe. I was very attentive. I was more attentive than any of my comrades. All blind persons are, or can be. Thus, they attain the power of being completely present, sometimes even the power of changing life around them, a power the civilization of the 20th century, with its many diversions, no longer possesses. Being attentive unlocks a sphere of reality that no one suspects. If, for instance, I walked along a path without being attentive, completely immersed in myself, I did not even know whether trees grew along the way, nor how tall they were, or whether they had leaves. When I awakened my attention, however, every tree immediately came to me. This must be taken quite literally. Every single tree projected its form, its weight, its movement, even if it was almost motionless, in my direction. I could indicate its trunk and the place where its first branches started, even when several feet away. By and by, something else became clear to me, and this can never be found in books. The world exerts pressure on us from the distance. The seeing commit a strange error. They believe that we know the world only through our eyes. For my part, I discovered that the universe consists of pressure, that every object and every living being reveals itself to us at first by a kind of quiet yet unmistakable pressure that indicates its intention and its form. I even experienced the following wonderful fact. A voice, the voice of a person, permits him to appear in a picture. When the voice of a man reaches me, I immediately perceive his figure, his rhythm, and most of all, his intentions. Even stones are capable of weighing on us from a distance. So are the outlines of distant mountains, and the sudden depression of a lake at the bottom of a valley. This correspondence is so exact that when I walked arm in arm with a friend along the paths of the Alps, I knew the landscape and could sometimes describe it with surprising clarity. Sometimes? Yes, only sometimes. I could do it when I summoned all my attention. Permit me to say without reservation that if all people were attentive, if they would undertake to be attentive every moment of their lives, they would discover the world anew. They would suddenly see that the world is entirely different from what they had believed it to be. All science would become obsolete in a single moment, and we should enter into the miracle